I'm glad we did it, but I think the working group really missed an opportunity to make some meaningful changes.
A new legislative report on oil tax credits recommends minimal changes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 1st. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, part social worker, part law enforcement, the role of a good probation officer.
I used to joke that with some of the offenders on my caseload, I need to be able to claim them on my income taxes dependents because they're just like my children.
Those stories tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Governor Bill Walker is expected to release his budget in the next few weeks, and one thing it will likely include, cuts to tax credits for oil companies. The state paid out more than $500 million in refundable tax credits this past year and gave up another $500 million in credits deducted from taxes. With a $3.5 billion budget hole, that's a tempting target, but many lawmakers worry it's not a smart one. Today, a group of senators issued a report recommending few changes to the credits. APRN's Rachel Waldholtz reports.
Anchorage Republican Senator Kathy Geisel convened the Senate's Working Group on Oil Tax Credits and presided over the hearings it held this fall. She says she came away with one overriding concern.
Without the tax credits, I'm concerned that these smaller companies will pull back.
Those would be smaller companies like Hillcore, Kalis, Bluecrest Energy, and Fury, which have all ramped up operations in the state in the last decade. Alaska is counting on these independent companies to explore smaller fields that aren't attractive to the major producers, and it has provided hefty incentives to jumpstart that work. The question now is, can the state afford it? Last year, Alaska paid out almost $630 million in credits while collecting just about $300 million in production taxes, historically the mainstay of the state budget. But Geisel says if the state pulls back too soon, it risks losing out on the investments it's already made.
Once production happens, we start getting property tax, corporate income tax, royalties. We want to make sure those companies cross that threshold to production.
Geisel says some changes are necessary. She'd like to make sure that a company can't receive so many credits that it drops below the 4% minimum tax floor. If a company that received credits goes bankrupt, she'd like protections in place to make sure Alaska contractors that did business with them are shielded. And looking ahead to future years, she thinks perhaps credits shouldn't be stackable, so a company can't pile up multiple credits to virtually eliminate its expenses. But at the end of the day, she says, the credits are doing their job, and her report recommends avoiding any major changes in the coming 12 months.
The companies, as I said, have been very clear. We understand what the state is facing, but we need lead time to adjust our investments.
Senator Bill Willikowski, an Anchorage Democrat, was also in the working group.
I'm glad we did it, but I think the working group really missed an opportunity to make some meaningful changes.
Willikowski says the status quo is simply unsustainable. Something's got to give, and soon. One issue, he says, is that the group didn't address a whole type of credits, those that can be deducted from their taxes. These are taken largely by the major North Slope producers.
And this was not discussed at all. We had a tax credit working group meeting that didn't hear from BP, Conoco, and Exxon. How do you have any discussion on all tax credits, oil and gas, period, without involving BP, Conoco, or Exxon in the discussion?
But Willikowski says the biggest issue is just understanding what the state is getting in return. What projects truly need credits, and what kind of a return does Alaska get on its millions of investment? Those are still largely mysteries, he says.
Even when we had, even under ACES, we never knew what we were getting for that. We never knew, like, did the companies really need these, or were these just, you know, the shotgun approach where you're just providing these massive credits and sometimes they help and sometimes they don't.
But on one thing, both senators agree. This will be a hot topic when lawmakers meet in Juneau come January. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
Juneau's newly elected mayor was found dead in his home Monday afternoon. Greg Fisk was 70 years old. Juneau Police spokesperson Aaron Kalwara says his son Ian Fisk had gone to the house because Fisk had missed several appointments during the day. He saw his father's body through a window. Kalwara says Fisk had sustained injuries.
were unable to share a lot of information about where those injuries were or what they involved. However, they were not consistent with a gunshot wound or anything of that nature. It's not out of question that the injuries could have been caused by a natural event or an accident. We don't know that it's definitely criminal in nature.
Kalwara says Fisk's home is still an active investigation scene. An autopsy is scheduled for tomorrow. Juneau police have said they can't determine a cause of death for Fisk without those results. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more about the investigation.
Police blocked off a part of Kennedy Street and searched in and around Fisk's home throughout the evening. Chief Bryce Johnson said the investigation will continue Tuesday morning.
We're documenting the residents about where everything is, exactly how things are placed, any evidence that may be in there as to what could have caused the death.
Rumors circulated Monday night that Fisk may have been assaulted. Johnson said other plausible theories also exist, like a fall or a heart attack. There didn't appear to be a break-in at Fisk's house or suspicion of suicide. Just after 9 p.m., Kennedy Street was reopened and Fisk's body was taken from his home. It'll be sent to the state medical examiner's office in Anchorage for an autopsy. Johnson said it's unknown how long Fisk had been dead before he was found. He confirmed people were unable to contact Fisk Monday morning, which prompted his son Ian to check on him.
It's a great loss for the community, so we want to make sure that we can tell the community what happened. And that's our job. And I think the community deserves to know what happened and have it investigated properly.
Assembly member and deputy mayor Mary Becker said she last spoke with Fisk on the phone Sunday. She said he had planned to be absent from the assembly meeting scheduled for Monday night and had asked her to lead it.
We just generally talked briefly about what was happening on the agenda and that was it. He was very upbeat and sounded just like Greg.
Becker is responsible for mayoral duties for now. Juneau City Attorney will determine what happens next. Fisk was admired for being a limitless source of ideas. Here's Assemblymember Jesse Keel.
The way he jumped in to work on things made you want to work on them harder than you were before and really, really inspired you to go after it.
On Monday night, neighbors on Star Hill gathered in the street to remember Fisk. Fisheries historian Bob King was Fisk's next-door neighbor, good friend, and the chairman of his mayoral campaign. Fisk was elected as the city's mayor in October, beating incumbent Merrill Sanford by a margin of 2-1.
It's just so sad that a person with so much promise, so many great ideas, would be snuffed so soon within his term as mayor.
Fisk leaves behind his son Ian and grandson Kai. With help from Jennifer Canfield and Mika Wilson, I'm Lisa Fu in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a cultural exchange as Girdwood kids visit a school near the U.S. Capitol.
And I see the bear. No. Do you be scared if the bear is like right where you live at? Do you be scared?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
One of the first stops for everyone leaving prison is the probation and parole office in downtown Anchorage. People are required to check in within 24 hours of release. Parole officers have two major roles, law enforcers and social workers. Both help keep the community safe. For our series, Hitting Reset, KSKA Urban Affairs reporter Ann Hillman spent a day with a parole officer.
Okay, go ahead and turn, please. Thank you, sir.
Parole Officer Denise McKinsey scans parolee Tyson Davis with a detection wand, then lets him through the door. It's time for his monthly required check-in. McKinsey asks about his life.
So you have self-employed?
I am.
So you're still doing construction?
Yeah.
homes for the same guy?
Yes, we're building a house for him.
Through church, yeah, the same guy through church.
Mm-hmm.
Did you go to church?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Excellent.
I'm doing well in that regard.
Davis talks about getting medical treatment and visiting his mom. Within 10 minutes, their conversation is over. No red flags, no need for a urine analysis, or UA. Mackenzie cheers his successes and offers support to help him with the 12-step program. Because that's what she does. She's a cheerleader, a best friend, and a mom.
I used to joke that with some of the offenders on my caseload, I need to be able to claim them on my income taxes dependents because they're just like my children.
Mackenzie gets very involved with her offenders' lives. She knows their partners, their parents. She feels the emotional impact if they die.
When they overdose, that's the worst, because what could I have done to get them into the office, get them a UA? It would have been better to send them to jail than to see them die.
She sees her role as helping people lead stable lives by connecting them to resources that help them find housing and jobs. Mackenzie says, ultimately, stability means offenders won't commit another crime, and it makes the community safer for everyone.
It comes down to, we are, as a community, only as strong as the least among us. And my job is to make the people that are on my caseload stronger and a bigger part of the community. Because until they can rise, none of us can, really.
Mackenzie is part of a larger cultural shift within the Probation and Parole Division of the Department of Corrections. The division's leaders are trying to focus on ways to connect offenders to community resources and help them be healthy and productive. To that end, Mackenzie uses different tools, like random urine testing, to help people manage and treat their substance use issues instead of just throwing them back in jail. She uses her discretion. Being a parole officer is a job with a lot of gray areas. For Davis, who's been on parole for more than 3 years, Mackenzie's approach is working. He says that's not always the case. Not everyone has a great relationship with their PO.
I think it has a lot to do with who you get as a PO as well. You get the different type of personalities, and I'm super blessed to have mine. I'm really blessed.
Parolee Jimmy Tulafano has a different officer, not Mackenzie, and their relationship is more mixed. He says part of the problem is he's not always sure he understands what's expected of him, which is frustrating.
Sometimes I feel like I just want to just give up and just rather be in jail sometimes, but then you get to thinking, like, that ain't really where you want to be, you know?
Do you feel like your PO is on your side?
Sometimes. Yeah, sometimes I think she is, and then sometimes I just think she just throw me to the wolves.
Tulafano likens parole to adult babysitting.
I'm a grown-ass man, excuse my French, you know, and it's like, that's what people feel like, but at the same time, you're on a leash. You're not free no more. Your life belongs to them for the next couple of years.
P.O. Mackenzie says some people can't handle all of the rules. Even Tulafano's been back to jail a couple of times. Mackenzie estimates that 30 to 35 people leave the office every week in handcuffs for having violated conditions of parole or for committing new crimes. Some people simply don't show up for appointments and have warrants out for their arrest. That's when her role as law enforcement officer kicks in.
If it's an offender that it's going sideways and committing crimes, my job is to get out there and try to find them and stop them.
Mackenzie says it's about striking a balance to help keep the community safe and the parolees moving ahead with their lives.
The reality is you run across people that are on felony supervision each and every day, and you may not realize it. They have jobs. If you go into a restaurant in Anchorage, there's somebody on supervision probably working in that restaurant, and they're doing an exceptionally good job, and they're doing what they need to do to be members of our community.
And to help them keep doing that, Mackenzie says she has to be versatile and approach each person as an individual. She says she has 79 people on her caseload, so she has to be 79 different POs. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
That story is part of our radio series, Hitting Reset. Join us for a more in-depth discussion of successful prisoner reentry during a live community forum at 7 p.m. this Thursday at the Alaska Public Media Studios. Go to alaskapublic.org for more information or to see the entire series. The city of Sitka has released its police department operating procedures manual to the public. The 342-page document was posted on the city's website last week in the wake of a viral video showing a high school student being tased in the Sitka jail. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The Operating Procedures Manual, or OPM, is based on operating procedures used by the Alaska State Troopers. Lance Ewers is a former trooper and now serves as one of two lieutenants in the Sitka Police Department.
I think what we're literally living through is an evolution in law enforcement.
Ewers believes that allowing people to fully understand police procedures is important to understanding why we created police forces historically, rather than giving police duties to the military.
So what we're seeing here is a giant step, you know, a beautiful step backwards in time, where we're remembering that there is no us versus them. There's only us, and we are the people, and the people are the police. So why wouldn't we want the people to know what the rule book is?
The 342-page manual covers everything from wearing the uniform to operation of police vehicles to bioterrorism. In the aftermath of the tasing video, many people will probably be turning to Chapter 104, which covers the use of force. The video shows two officers and a jailer escorting 18-year-old Franklin Hugendorn, then a student at Mount Edgecombe High School, into the Sitka jail after his arrest in September of last year on charges of disorderly conduct. Over the course of the engagement, the three officers physically restrain Hugendorn, removing all his clothing except for his underwear, while repeatedly tasing him in the thigh. The specific levels of force demonstrated in the Hugendorn video aren't spelled out in detail in the operating procedures manual. Lieutenant Ewers says this is where police training comes into play.
We can't, you know, punish somebody in the use of force. You can't bring punishment on them. You could use force to gain safe control, but once safe control is obtained, you have to de-escalate the amount of force that you're using.
Sitka Police Chief Sheldon Schmidt has defended the conduct of the officers in the video, saying the arrest conformed to police procedures and that Hugendorn was combative with officers from the moment they confronted him outside of a Sitka bar. Lieutenant Ewers says that police don't use force in proportion to the amount of resistance they receive. Rather, we require them to always win the upper hand and gain safe control. As long as the force used is reasonable, and he emphasizes reasonable, police are acting appropriately.
Some people might look at a situation where there's three police officers and all three officers are trying to restrain one person. And they might look at that and think, oh, those three guys, there's three on one, that's not fair. But in reality, by having three officers, you could use less force than having one officer, because one officer by himself has to use more force and is actually legally justified in using more force to take ensure that they win safe control in a certain engagement.
The operating procedures manual requires the documentation of any force used by police beyond routine handcuffing. The FBI will be conducting an investigation into the Hugendorn arrest to determine if proper procedures were followed. The assistant district attorney subsequently dropped all five charges against Hugendorn, and he returned to his home village of Koyuk. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks is training employees how to respond to workplace violence. UA spokesperson Kate Wadham says sessions happening this week at the Butrovich Administrative Center are aimed at teaching building staff about their options in the event of a shooting incident.
About running, hiding, and fighting in the decision processes that people need to make when confronted with different aspects of a dynamic situation. And also the UAF police officer who's going to be doing the training is going to be shooting a weapon in the building in an isolated area so people can hear what it sounds like within the building.
The training is in preparation for an active shooter exercise scheduled for December 8th. Wadham says the exercise will involve an actor walking through the building. She says there will be no aggressive action toward employees, but it will give them experience responding quickly.
I know I'm supposed to run, I know I'm supposed to hide or fight, but you have to have a little bit of pressure to be able to put people in a situation where they have to make that critical decision.
Wadham says the first ever exercise will include feedback from trainers.
We will have people on site monitoring and assessing how everybody behaves and responds, and there will be situations where people will find out very clearly, immediately, that these aren't good places to be or this isn't a good hiding spot.
She says a similar exercise will be held at a University of Alaska Anchorage building.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations and communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
On Thursday, December 3rd, Alaska Pacific University is hosting an open house from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. in the Carr Gottstein Lobby. Learn about environmental science, outdoor and environmental education, and K-8 teaching certification programs. To find out where these APU programs can take you, hashtag ThisIsOurClassroom. This message sponsored by APU.
The board tasked with writing rules for Alaska's recreational marijuana industry discussed possible changes to residency requirements for pot business licenses this morning in Anchorage. On November 20th, the Marijuana Control Board approved using the residency requirements needed to vote in Alaska. That means living here and intending to stay or leaving the state with the intent to return. One also couldn't be registered to vote elsewhere. This was meant to be less restrictive than an earlier proposal to use the same residency requirements as those needed to qualify for PFD, but the board's director questioned the ability of the board's limited staff to verify that applicants aren't registered to vote elsewhere. A new citizen-sponsored initiative in Anchorage is seeking to repeal a recently passed anti-discrimination ordinance. Referendum materials show conservative talk show host Bernadette Wilson as the measure's main sponsor. It asks Anchorage voters whether or not they support a repeal of AO 96, the city measure adding protections for sexual orientation and gender identity to the city's anti-discrimination laws. The ordinance passed in September by a vote of 9-2 in the city's assembly. Deputy Clerk Amanda Mosier says the potential ballot measure still needs to be reviewed by municipal attorneys to make sure it meets legal standards.
From there, the contact person gathers signatures, and the signatures are based on voter turnout in the previous mayoral regular election. It's 10% of voters, so that's 5,754 voters.
Those signatures will need to be gathered by January 11th if the measure is to go before voters on the April ballot. A spruce tree from the Chugach National Forest is standing tall on the lawn of the U.S. Capitol today. Governor Bill Walker is in Washington, D.C. for tomorrow's lighting ceremony. Among the other Alaskans in D.C. for the event are two students and a teacher from Girdwood. Today, they acted as cultural ambassadors, explaining all things Alaskan to a group of Washington school children. APRN's Liz Ruskin caught up with them.
Minor Elementary School is just 2 miles from the U.S. Capitol, but it's in a neighborhood that doesn't see many tourists, and the students at Minor don't get to tour outside their city much. So it was a special event when three Alaskans walked in to Ms. Hicks's fourth grade class.
My name is Jack Hickox, and I'm a fourth grader at Girdwood School.
My name's Nolan Quigley, and I'm in 7th grade at Girdwood School.
I'm Molly Hickox, and I teach 5th grade at Girdwood K-8.
Molly Hickox participates in a Forest Service education program, and she thought it'd be a good idea to connect with a local classroom while they're in Washington for the Christmas tree lighting. They showed the class a slideshow with maps to explain where the tree came from and how it traveled to D.C. The Washington kids, though, were most interested in the pictures of Girdwood and in animals. One child noticed that the Girdwood map showed a drawing of a bear right where Nolan said his house was.
And I see the bear. Nolan, do you be scared if 'cause the bear is like right where you live at? Do you be scared?
The Alaskans explained that sometimes recess is canceled when there's an animal on the playground, but they said maulings are rare. Hickox, the Girdwood teacher, explained the importance of wildlife safety rules and bear-proof garbage cans.
That's why we spend a lot of time teaching everybody how to be safe around bear and moose. There aren't any animals that are out to get you.
The Washington kids were fascinated by the last picture in the slideshow of Jack on Mount Alyeska.
Yeah, that's a picture of me skiing.
Wow.
The kids asked a lot about that.
I have a question for when Jack was skiing. Was that a class trip or was that just on a weekend?
Jack and Nolan explained they ski lots on weekends, even on a few Thursday afternoons when Girdwood School lets out early so everybody can ski. After the presentation, some kids hung around the Alaskan boys with more questions. Others tried to fathom these animals they'd heard about.
I think a moose is as big as a deer.
Yeah, a deer.
Or maybe a polar bear?
No.
No, not a polar bear. A polar bear is huge, girl.
Some thought it might be scary to go to Alaska.
So I'd be afraid of a bear because if I didn't know what to do for a bear, I would probably get eaten.
The Washington fourth graders, though, think nothing of riding the subway or public bus by themselves. That's how some of them get to school. Even younger kids do that without their parents. They said they couldn't imagine why some Alaskans think big cities aren't safe.
No, I did not, because in Alaska, kids, I don't know why they would think it's scary, because I mean, the cities is not scary because it don't have like dangerous stuff like bears. The city, it has mostly birds, cats, dogs, and squirrels and stuff.
Off to the side of the classroom, Washington teacher Diana Hicks was beaming. Ms. Hicks says she's all about bridging the culture gaps.
I love to see different cultures together. I love seeing the children enjoy each other, finding out that you may look different, but we have things in common. So for them right now, like I can see all of them are like really enamored right now with Jack and Nolan, because they're like, oh, wow, you're just like I am. So they're learning about the world. I want them to see things outside D.C. because so many of my children don't leave their neighborhoods.
A group called Choose Outdoors raised corporate contributions to bring the tree from Alaska to the Capitol. Sponsors, including Alaska Airlines, also covered the cost of the trip for the Girdwood Trio. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz, Ann Hillman, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Lisa Fu in Juneau, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web editor. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.